It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On March 10th, Silicon Valley Bank collapsed. This bank was known for its place in the startup ecosystem. The New York Times reports that the Fed was assessing the strength of the bank's risk management earlier this year. For someone looking to open their business or launch a startup right now, the risks might seem high. Dave Mawinney is the executive director of the Swartz Center for Entrepreneurship at Carnegie Mellon University. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Delighted to be here. Long-time listener, first-time guest.
Thank you. I mean, right now, whether it's students, researchers, entrepreneurs that you're working with, are they expressing any concerns about the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank? And what are you saying to them?
Yeah, for the first time, these young entrepreneurs are facing a crisis. And so their reaction is to be afraid, to maybe have a little bit of panic. Our job is to try to calm them down, because the truth is there's been many of these crises in the past. I've been through four of them myself: the 2008 financial collapse, the dot-com crash in 2000, 9/11 shortly thereafter, and at the very beginning of my career, the 1987 crash. So things will get better. And what's most important for these entrepreneurs is to focus on the situation that they face, not the overall situation, but the situation they face.
So those experiences that you just enumerated, some good came out of, quote, the bad, and you can share those experiences with these young entrepreneurs.
Yes, absolutely. And so, you know, your situation is different than everybody else's. So if you focus on what's important for your company, your startup, you can usually power through the noise, the ambiguity, and the uncertainty that is around you. And you can't control that. So you can only control what's in front of you. So that's what we teach the entrepreneurs.
All right. So, but I can't help but hearing this. Do you have a central message about the overall economic environment right now?
Yeah, it's a tough overall economic environment. In the downturn of 2022, a lot of our capital-intensive startups ran into walls and problems, companies like Fifth Season or Locomation. And there are other companies out there that are, you know, dealing with difficult times right now. But that's very different than what happened with Silicon Valley Bank. Silicon Valley Bank is more of a banking industry issue than a startup company issue. And thank goodness the Fed stood in and guaranteed all deposits. So now that the younger startups that might have had increased anxiety with the downturn and then the banking crisis don't have to worry about the banking crisis, because the Fed has got it under control right now.
So do they listen to you as far as being is optimistic too strong of a word?
No, it's not. I think if you're going to be an entrepreneur, being optimistic all the time is an important thing, because there are bad things that are going to happen. So you have to train your mind to continue to be positive in the face of uncertainty, in the face of challenges. And that's what we try to do with our entrepreneurs at Carnegie Mellon.
All right. You've mentioned, of course, the Silicon Valley Bank. You've mentioned 2022, the downturn. You mentioned 2008 and going back for even after 9/11, what that did to our economy, and back even farther. So from your experience, can a crisis be a good time to grow a business?
Actually, paradoxically, it's the best time to start a business, because people who were formerly employed in high-paying jobs, especially engineers and software developers, may be on the market now, may be willing to work for less money than they did before because the tough times have ahead. So as it turns out in history, some of the best companies are started in the aftermath of crises.
Is it a good time for creativity? Maybe someone is shifting to a different field, a different industry.
It's always a good time for that, Kevin, but it's a particularly good time for that right now because of the talent that's available on the marketplace to join you in that creative venture.
Have you found that, all right, people are recognizing this talent, they're recognizing that idea might work, but is the support to get them moving forward, to take the next steps?
Right. The real entrepreneurs will dive into an opportunity using creativity, innovation, and hard work without regard to the resources currently at hand. They are confident enough in what they're going after that they believe that they will be able to put the resources together. And what we do at Carnegie Mellon with the Schwartz Center for Entrepreneurship and organizations like Innovation Works in the region, the state-based seed capital fund, is we provide an ecosystem that provides those resources, and we provide education and networking to help them plug into those resources as they need them.
Center was founded in 2015?
Yes.
Okay. The mission is bringing research and ideas to the global marketplace. The center offers undergraduate and graduate courses in founding and maintaining a business. So are you seeing students interested in entrepreneurship, or are they saying, hold it, I'd rather work for someone than work for myself?
Well, in this last academic year, 22-23, with the downturn, what we saw was a increased interest in entrepreneurship. And I think it's for a couple of reasons. One is the job market's tough, so there's time to sort of seek things out on their own. But I think really what's happening with the real entrepreneurs is they realize that there's no safety in a larger company anymore, and that if they want to control their own destiny, they got to grab the bull by the horns and start their own thing.
Are there particular sectors that are doing well as far as young entrepreneurs, you know, taking a chance?
Well, there was a quote by Mark Andreessen a decade ago, say, software's eating the world. Well, if that is true, then artificial intelligence is gobbling it up. Artificial intelligence was invented at Carnegie Mellon in the 1950s by Herb Simon and Alan Newell, and we've continued to be a leader in this field. Artificial intelligence has led to the advancement of robotics. It's led to the advancements of autonomous vehicles. So I think artificial intelligence in its many forms, very popular right now because of ChatGPT, ChatGPT-4, DALL-E, is an opportunity for any entrepreneur to reimagine almost everything that we do in our daily lives to enhance it with artificial intelligence.
Herb Simon, I believe, a Nobel Prize winner.
Yes, in economics, absolutely.
Right. And for students that might be unsure, are they just sort of ingrained with this confidence in themselves that, you know, you say, I'm going to get my idea out there and the support, the financial support will come. But if they might be unsure, concerned about the future, what's your advice to them?
Believe in yourself, right? You know, at the end of the day, you have to have that self-confidence that will allow you to overcome those short-term challenges and barriers. Mm-hmm. And so we really work hard to help our entrepreneurs develop those skills. And they can do it through, you know, using, you know, envisioning themselves that way. They can use it by doing positive self-talk.
Mm-hmm. Dave, how can marginalized entrepreneurs, BIPOC, disabled, queer folks ensure they're getting the support they need in today's economic environment?
I think they need to raise their hand and ask for help. The good news is here in Pittsburgh, we have a very inclusive environment. Certainly we do at Carnegie Mellon and the Schwartz Center. And everybody who asks for help at the Schwartz Center is going to get help.
Okay. And finally, what about the global economy? We've been talking a little bit about the national economy, but how about the global economy? How can that be a learning opportunity for those who are coming through your center?
Well, interestingly, Carnegie Mellon is the most global or international of all the top universities. It's literally like a United Nations when you're walking around the campus. So it's really great that our students get to learn with people who come from different backgrounds and different points of view. And so that's a really important part of being an entrepreneur going forward.
Dave Mawinney is the Executive Director of the Schwartz Center for Entrepreneurship at Carnegie Mellon University. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kevin. Have a great day.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2013, the Sisters of St. Joseph of Baden created a resource in Pittsburgh for Latino immigrants. A decade later, this resource, Casa San Jose, is a nonprofit with about 24 employees and 100 volunteers. Sister Janice Vanderneck is the founding director and director of civic engagement for Casa San Jose. She joins us now. Welcome, Sister Janice.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm honored to speak to both you, Kevin, and your listeners.
Sister, how did you get the idea to start a resource center of this kind?
Well, I had experience working in the Amazon in Brazil for a number of years with the Sisters of St. Joseph. And I always say I learned so much more than I was ever able to contribute during those few years. But I got on the ground experience of the socioeconomic situation in Latin America, as well as, more importantly, the church's teaching and the church's engagement as defined by its document out of Medellin, the preferential option for the poor. So I started learning in Latin America. And then when I came to this country, returned back home to this country, I constantly had this longing within me to work with Latino immigrants. And then not only did I have that longing, but the need was growing and growing. The diocese had an office for service to Latino immigrants, but then that grant ran out and it closed. Mm-hmm. And so the need was still great.
All right, the need was there. You mentioned the diocese and the grant and some of the services they had been provided. What were other resources, maybe from our government, the city or county, were they doing anything, this kind of work at that level?
Well, in 2003, when I first started as part of the diocese, I was running all over interpreting and advocating. And by the time 2013 rolled around, we opened our doors. And the next year, the Department of Human Services of Allegheny County gave us a grant so that we could hire bilingual resource workers to connect
right.
the immigrants to resources.
Okay. Casa San Jose offers social services, legal services, tutoring, youth mentoring. During the lockdown, we talked to members of your staff about the difficulties of getting Spanish language resources about COVID and the vaccine out to Pittsburghers. Do you still find that the Latino community is not getting resources in their native languages?
The growth in interpretation, the availability of interpretation has been phenomenal since 2003 or even since 2013. And part of that is because of the tremendous input from the Department of Human Services of Allegheny County. Also, Pittsburgh's city of Pittsburgh and Allegheny County government have been working towards immigrant inclusion and making a welcome for immigrants. And part of that has been providing interpretation and policies that will make the immigrants feel welcome. So those have been really contributive towards our success as Casa San Jose. Mm-hmm.
The pandemic highlighted the need for accessibility in all areas, not just language. Do you think some agencies are doing better in that realm?
Oh, most definitely. We were very, very blessed to be able to provide food during the pandemic, actual financial resources, because our people lacking a social security number were not eligible to receive the stimulus. So we've been very grateful for the unsolicited donations we've received all along the way. Tremendous goodwill, probably among many of your listeners, towards making immigrants feel welcome, as well as providing resources for persons who come here with nothing.
How were you able to get resources to people who weren't able to get assistance, those without social security numbers?
Yes, we received grants. The foundation community came together to respond to COVID in many, many ways, one of which was helping us provide that input of financial resource funds so that the families did not suffer hunger and homelessness.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned just some of the services that Casa San Jose offers. Right now, what are your biggest, maybe your most popular programs?
We are very, very pleased with the youth programs that we have been able to grow over the years. From the get-go, providing connections to resources, social services, as well as working with youth have been our priorities. And working with youth has its foundations in wanting to help the youth bridge the two cultures, mm-hmm. as well as bridge their to their future. Navigating two cultures, one lived in your home when you return there after school, and then the one lived in school, bridging these two cultures is a challenge. Okay. And so we've been able to get into high schools and other public schools.
What programs do you want to launch, but maybe you just haven't found the time or funding to do so? And of course, you're going to have a new center pretty soon.
Yes. English as a second language is unfortunately full. We need to expand that English as a second language. So that would be a place where I wish we had more resources to be able to do that. And I'm thrilled that the people want to give the time to learn the English. And we are very thrilled that we're going to have our own building. We've been rented. Well, our first place was in St. Mark's Evangelical Lutheran Church, a free space. And soon we will be in our own space, which will be so significant.
Sister Janice, you've been operating for 10 years. What have you learned?
I have learned that I can't do everything for everybody. And Casa San Jose can't either. However, we certainly do try. Unfortunately, our government has not shown the political will to provide immigration reform. And that is so desperately needed. That is what I know the future needs to hold.
And very, very briefly, how can Pittsburgh be more welcoming?
If you see an immigrant, say hi. Invite immigrants to be with you for a while. Ask if you can give them a ride to the grocery store. Any efforts you can do to welcome.
Sister Janice Vanderneck is the founding director and director of civic engagement of Casa San Jose Pittsburgh. Sister Janice, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Despite the city's many hills and valleys, downtown Pittsburgh is pretty flat. But it wasn't always that way. For our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports on the history of Grant's Hill in the Golden Triangle and what happened to the so-called hump.
Good question asker Raymond Katevich from Elizabeth Township has
always been curious about Pittsburgh and things that were here and things that are no longer here. And one of the things I came across was Grant's Hill. And I always wondered where it was and why it was so necessary to remove it and why it was so inconvenient to everybody.
Grant's Hill once spanned an area from what's now the U.S. Steel Tower to the Boulevard of the Allies. Before Pittsburgh was developed, it was a roughly 33-foot-tall rocky mound covered in trees, surrounded by ponds. According to University of Pittsburgh history professor Edward K. Muller, Grant's Hill
plays some important roles in the history of the city.
Muller says there were two big events at Grant's Hill, beginning with how it got its name. First, a quick history lesson. In 1758, British General John Forbes was sent across Pennsylvania to kick the French and their Native American allies out of Fort Duquesne at the Point. Before he reaches the city, Forbes dispatched Major James Grant and several hundred men to Pittsburgh to get an idea of what they were up against.
But Grant had bigger ideas of glory and decided that he would surprise the French.
The area was covered with dense forest, and Grant chose a small hill as the base of his attack. But the French ambushed him, and hundreds of his troops were killed, wounded, or captured. Despite the defeat, the mound was later named Grant's Hill. The French eventually abandoned Fort Duquesne, and General Forbes took control of the area. As Pittsburgh grew and expanded beyond the point, Grant's Hill was used as a park, where families gathered to picnic and play music. But others criticized Grant's Hill, saying it was a nuisance and needed to go, to clear the way for future development.
But it was big enough to be an issue at various times.
In 1836, the top third of the hump was removed in an attempt to bring its height closer to the rest of the growing downtown area. Still, some felt it wasn't enough. Here's an excerpt from an 1839 Pittsburgh Gazette article.
"Level this hill, with the exception of the ornamental buildings which are upon it, and let our citizens see the fine scenery beyond. And Pittsburgh will show, like every large and flourishing city, an abundance of employment and accommodation for her industrious family."
In 1841, Allegheny County decided to build a new courthouse, a Greek Revival-style structure along Grant Street.
By moving the courthouse up there, it begins a several-decade drift of insurance companies, lawyers, and others in that direction. You know, that is in part reshaping downtown.
When that courthouse burned down in 1882, the county asked architect H.H. Richardson to design a new one. This is the Romanesque Revival-style building that still stands today. But Mueller says there was still a discussion taking place on how Grant's Hill was impacting the city's growth. City planners wanted to level the area, but some prominent owners of nearby buildings, including Henry Clay Frick, weren't convinced.
Frick was a holdout in this. And he and other property owners, you know, if they were going to cut this thing down, which would mean having to do something about the foundation and the bottom floors, who was going to cover damages?
Eventually, in 1912, Mayor William McGee figured out a way around the opposition. He issued a construction bond to the tune of $3 million and ensured Frick that the work would go smoothly. Frick signed on. They removed the rest of Grant's Hill, reinforcing the foundations and basements of the buildings that were standing upon it. They cut down quite a bit.
16 feet.
There are still a few reminders of the event, including a plaque on the Frick building.
If you stand at the corner of 5th and Grant, you can see a marker that says this was the height before Grant's Hill was cut down. And it's been there a long, long time.
It can be hard to picture the hump today, but the removal of Grant's Hill changed downtown and helped solidify Grant Street as one of the main thoroughfares of the Golden Triangle. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a major study on the opioid use ecosystem explores the impact not only those who use opioids, but also on families, friends, the community, our entire health system, and government policies. Thanks to our team, Emma Furry, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.